This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 22, 2005. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. After striking for 3 days, New York City transit workers agree to go back to work. As the issue of immigration heats up nationally, immigrant workers continue to organize locally. And the city of Portland says it's resisting new requirements from the Environmental Protection Agency. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Senate agreed last night to extend the expiring provisions of the USA Patriot Act for another 6 months. From Capitol Hill, Mitch Jezrich reports.
With just 10 days remaining until 16 of the most controversial measures of the Patriot Act expire, Senate negotiators struck a deal to extend it as it is until the middle of next year. Last Friday, the Patriot Act reauthorization bill was blocked by a Senate filibuster, as some lawmakers believe that it lacked enough judicial oversight on how the act is used. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle say an additional 6 months should give Congress enough time to reach an agreement. Some of the sunsetting provisions include sections that give the FBI access to library, medical, and business records, and to allow the FBI to use roving wiretaps. Also set to expire is the sneak and peek provision that allows the government to enter one's premises without notifying the occupant until several months later. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
An appeals court has ruled against the Bush administration's request to transfer a high-profile terrorism suspect. From Tampa, Andrew Stelzer has the details.
Saying the Bush administration had risked its credibility before the court, appeals court judge J. Michael Luttig yesterday denied the U.S. Justice Department's request to transfer terrorism suspect Jose Padilla from military to civilian detention. Padilla was held for 3 years without charge on suspicion of planning to explode a radioactive dirty bomb. He was recently indicted on an unrelated count, but Padilla has a case pending before the Supreme Court challenging the extent of the president's power to hold so-called enemy combatants without charges. The administration had argued that the transfer from a military brig in South Carolina to law enforcement authorities in Miami would render the case before the Supreme Court moot and should be dismissed, but the judge ruled against the transfer and said the Supreme Court hearing should take place. The decision also questioned why the administration used one set of accusations before the court for 3.5 years to justify holding Padilla without charges, but another with a Florida grand jury last month. The judge said it created the appearance the government may be attempting to avoid high court review of the case. The appeals court also rejected the government's request that it set aside a ruling that allowed Padilla to be held as an enemy combatant without being charged. Wiping out that ruling would have made it virtually impossible for the Supreme Court to review the case. From WMNF in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
In Miami, family members and supporters of jailed Haitian priest and human rights activist Gerard Janjus gathered yesterday to call for his release on medical grounds. This after dozens of congressional representatives made a similar plea to the Haitian government last week. Father Jean Just is reportedly in poor health, and a U.S. doctor who recently examined him in prison has indicated that he may be battling cancer. Meanwhile, election officials in Haiti have indicated to the BBC that the country's January 8th presidential elections may be postponed again. This would be the fourth time that the elections have been delayed. Haitians have been unable to pick their own political representatives since the elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was forced from power in February 2004. In Ethiopia, 131 people were formally charged yesterday with crimes against the state. Charges include conspiracy, high treason, and genocide. While many of the accused were charged in absentia, those present at the hearing were among those detained during multiple days of political unrest last month. Demonstrations erupted throughout Ethiopia's capital in early November in response to widespread allegation of election fraud. Dozens of protesting supporters of the opposition CUD party were killed by government security forces during the November unrest, and hundreds were detained. Among those charged yesterday with crimes against the state are opposition leaders and supporters, staff from non-governmental organizations, and a number of journalists. The charge of high treason is punishable by death. In environmental news, governors from 7 northeastern states have announced a first-of-its-kind pact to set legal limits on greenhouse emissions from power stations. Rebecca Miles reports from New York.
Under the pact known as the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the participating states have agreed to curb carbon dioxide emissions starting in 2009 by cutting emissions by 10% by 2019. The plan was endorsed by New Jersey, Delaware, Connecticut, Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. It is open to other states, but Rhode Island and Massachusetts have declined to sign, citing concerns of increased energy costs to their states. The bipartisan pact is being seen as a break with the Bush administration and is the initiative of New York Governor George Pataki, who began work on it in 2003. The pact was due to be announced to coincide with the climate change conference in Canada earlier this month, but the governor from Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, pulled out at the last minute. Under the RGGI, the signatories must proceed with required legislative or regulatory approvals to adopt the program. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
On Thursday afternoon, New York's Metropolitan Transit Authority and Transit Worker Union, or TWU, leaders agreed to resume talks and make moves to get the city's transport systems up and running again. State mediator Richard Carreri announced the decision at a press conference shortly before airtime.
In the best interests of the public, which both parties serve, we have suggested and they have agreed to resume negotiations while the TWU takes steps toward returning its membership to work. Mr. Toussaint and the TWU leadership have agreed to take this recommendation back with a positive recommendation to its executive board. The executive board has the power to put the membership back to work.
Exactly when transit workers will get back to work is unclear, as the TWU executive board has to make the final recommendation to its membership. Strong words from New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg calling the city's 33,700 transit workers thuggish drew an air of righteous indignation from Transport Worker Union Local 100 President Roger Toussaint.
We are not thugs. We are not selfish. We are not greedy. We are hardworking New Yorkers, dignified men and women who have put in decades of service to keep the city moving 24/7.
The last major transit strike to shut down the city took place in April of 1980 and lasted 11 days. While debate over immigration was prominent in the House of Representatives this past week, local communities continue to grapple with the issues locally. The bill passed in the House Saturday would treat undocumented workers as felons, and no provision for guest worker programs touted by President Bush were included. Christy Lee Puma Herrera and Darby Hickey bring us an update on how undocumented workers in Northern Virginia are dealing with the limited options presented to them.
Pues ahorita es primer día que vengo acá, porque bueno, yo dije voy a ir a ver cómo está la onda ya.
It's a cold first morning for Fernando at the New Herndon Official Workers Center, which opened a week ago. More than 50 day laborers huddle in groups while few contractors come through the parking lot where the men wait. Some gather around the heater blasting warm air, others order food from the vendor who sells pupusas and hot drinks. In the middle of the lot, the former site of a police station, a group of workers hover around a table that determines their employment for the day, a ticketed lottery system. Wilfredo, who looked for work in past years at the unofficial site outside 7-Eleven, says the new center is a marked contrast.
Yo pienso que está bien, así me gusta, pero...
I think this is a good system, but here it's just about luck. Whoever has their number drawn gets the work. For me, though, it's better because the old site was a lot more risky. Things are better here.
The controversial center opened against the wishes of some Herndon residents who did not want taxpayer money to support what they saw as a hub for undocumented workers. This past week, while opponents protested at the site, 45 minutes away in Washington, D.C., Congress members on Capitol Hill passed a bill that would have significant negative impact on the lives of these workers. David, who has done day labor for 2 years, says the government should be looking at solutions that account for the reality of undocumented workers who are already here and an important part of the U.S. society and economy.
I think they should look for a situation that's fair for everyone. Because we're looking for work and they're judging us like terrorists, we don't have anything to do with that. To pass laws against Latinos with the excuse of making anti-terrorist laws, I don't think that's fair.
Despite the lack of jobs for the moment, a lot of workers at the new center express hope that contractors will start coming more often as the seasons change, that planned center services like English and vocational classes will happen, and that government policies will improve. Again, David.
Uno trabaja para los americanos, hispanos, o los que vengan, va.
We work for Americans, Latinos, or whoever comes looking for workers. But we do it to lend them a hand, and they lend us a hand. Like it or not, they depend on us, and we also need them.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Chrissy Lipuma Herrera with Darby Hickey in Herndon, Virginia.
While immigrant workers continue to organize locally, other undocumented immigrants have been the target of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement's newer plan called Operation Community Shield. FSRN's Anastasia Nestitska reports from D.C., where the National Immigration Project has been discussing the deportation of alleged gang members and the new immigration bill just approved by the House that threatens the legal status of undocumented immigrants.
National Immigration Project has been studying the activity of the Operation Community Shield, a joint police and immigration initiative launched in February 2005 to protect the country against gang violence. According to Immigration Project data, 1,600 people were deported unlawfully. Paramita Shah, project director.
They really don't lay down the parameters of what constitutes a violent gang member. They say that they get information from local law enforcement. What isn't clear is how they identify gang members. And I have seen immigration documents that say things like, the person was dressed in baggy clothes like a gang member.
National Immigration Project criticized the way Operation Community Shield initiatives affect communities.
Mostly we worry that they're doing this with local police, because local police is supposed to be working with our communities. And in many cities, they have tried to work together with the communities to put together effective intervention programs to deal with gang violence. But these kinds of programs actually, I believe, disrupt those very programs that are designed and have been successful at reducing gang violence.
Another important event with regards to immigration discussed by the National Immigration Project is the Border Protection and Illegal Immigration Control Act, recently passed by the House. This act reduces due process rights of undocumented immigrants and criminalizes their relatives. It also turns police into immigration agent and treats the undocumented presence by immigrants as a felony. Despite criticism of this act by many immigrant groups, Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR, supports it. Jack Martin, Special Projects Director.
We think that in order to protect the fundamental principle of our nation being a nation of laws, that we need to take strong measures to discourage people from breaking our laws when they come into the country and to deny permanent residence to those people who have broken our laws.
The act, supported by 36 Democrats, is said to combat illegal immigration more than any bill in history. The Senate is expected to pass its own immigration legislation in February of 2006. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditskaya in Washington, D.C.
The International Monetary Fund, or IMF, ranked Iran as having the highest rate of brain drain in the world among some 61 countries in 2004. The IMF reports that every year more than 150,000 educated Iranians leave their country in the hope of finding a better life overseas. FSRN's Iranian Affairs correspondent Saida Jamshidi has more.
Haji Rahmandat graduated from a PhD program in management technology from MIT University in Boston. Haji left Iran more than 5 years ago after finishing his undergraduate degree in the number one Iranian Sharif University of Technology in Tehran. He believes he made the right decision to leave Iran.
From what I have seen, many of the students who have stayed inside Iran don't feel satisfied with their decision because they would say, well, we lost a lot of opportunities for growth and learning.
In the total number of Iranians living abroad, more than 58% of them have a university degree. And since 1979, the time of Iran's revolution, the United States hosted more than 2 million Iranians. Maurice Sheaf is the lead economist for the Research Program on International Migration and Development in World Bank and co-editor of International Migration, Remittance and the Brain Drain.
It's an extremely wealthy country, the United States. Where you get the standard of living that is extremely high for all these people. So that, of course, attracts academics are better paid in the United States compared to almost any place in the world. And in addition to being better paid, there's more money for research. And there's, of course, much more competition.
Among the 45 students admitted in computer science at the Sharif University of Technology, Harjir and 24 other students left Iran for the United States and Canada in 2001. Harjir believes in the United States.
The system here is very well organized, so if you do your work well, if you are doing research, if you do a good research, it is well accepted. You get rewarded for that.
Harjir also believes that the whole journey is meaningful when an immigrant meets new people, makes new friends, and experiences a new life. William Carrington is an economist who studied brain drain influence in given countries and on individuals.
Maybe that it's simply educated people are a bit more adventurous, more willing and more able to adapt to the different circumstances of the United States labor market, find it easier to learn English if that's not what they speak at their home.
Although education and financial opportunities may attract talented people to the United States, there is always a sense of responsibility for Harjir to contribute some of his energy to Iran.
I have an idea of trying to start to build some bridges between my work here and contributing to Iran by, for example, having workshops or classes or training sessions or teaching in universities during summer so that I kind of start to build more connections in Iran, build some network there.
Brain drain is discussed as a negative effect on given countries, but Carrington believes in two important benefits. First, talented immigrant can provide a bridge between two cultures, and second, they can provide money flow between two countries. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Saida Jamshidi.
The Environmental Protection Agency last week announced new safety requirements for U.S. cities with unfiltered water supplies to prevent disease caused by a waterborne pathogen. The city of Portland, Oregon, is resisting these requirements and has said that they will go as far as to sue the federal government to prove that their water should be exempt from the new regulations. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has more.
Cryptosporidium is a waterborne pathogen that, according to the Center for Disease Control, is the most common cause of disease outbreak related to public drinking water. This is why the Environmental Protection Agency has issued a regulation to protect cities with unfiltered water systems from an outbreak like the one that hit Milwaukee in 1993, infecting over 400,000 people.
We have the cleanest water in the world.
That's Randy Leonard, City Commissioner for Portland, Oregon, in charge of the city's Water Bureau.
When we get our drinking water here at our tap, there is no contamination possible from Cryptosporidium.
Portland's federally protected watershed, the Bull Run Reservoir at the base of Mount Hood, is safe from livestock and sewage, which are the most common sources of the pathogen. After this argument failed in negotiations with Washington, the city of Portland is gearing up to sue the federal government rather than comply with the EPA regulations that would require water treatment or filtration. Mike Gerhard heads the EPA Office for Water Quality in the Pacific Northwest. He says the science is not accurate enough to rule out other sources of contamination.
There are a number of highly protected surface water systems, watersheds around the country, including Seattle's and other places, and they are not opposing the major provisions of this rule.
Commissioner Leonard explains why Portland has chosen to resist the regulation.
We're not challenging the rule per se. We're actually saying the rule is fine, but that we believe that we comply with it with our ecosystem that exists in Mount Hood. I just see this as a really unnecessary expense that only enriches the contractor that would install the filter system. That's the only entity that would benefit.
Floyd Jones with the environmental organization Friends of the Reservoir says she supports the city's position.
Every environmental group is in agreement on this in the community. There's no dissension. If the only people that are going to benefit from this are the consultants, then why are we going to spend all that money when we have a water system that has significant needs in terms of maintenance?
Filtration or treatment could cost the city as much as $200 million, causing a spike in water and sewage rates. Director of the Portland Water Users Coalition, Kent Crayford, says rates would most likely go up by 74%.
When it comes to making trade-offs on a residential level for low-income people, you know, they're already strapped. And when it comes to business, I mean, this means jobs for a lot of businesses.
Crayford, along with representatives from other advocacy groups and environmental organizations, sits on the committee that will choose the firm to represent the city of Portland when it files suit against the EPA and the federal government in the new year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
There's growing concern about the Department of Energy's rationale for consolidating plutonium-238 production in Idaho. A congressional conference report says consolidating production will free up space for producing nuclear bomb cores at Los Alamos, New Mexico. As FSRN's Lee Robartes reports, this raises questions about the U.S.'s role in future nuclear weapons proliferation.
A House conference report from the Energy and Water Appropriations Committee reveals a new rationale for moving all plutonium-238 production to Idaho. PU-238 is used to power deep space probes and potentially spy devices distributed at remote locations around the planet. The report says more nuclear bomb cores, known as PITs, can be produced at a part of Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico called TA-55 if the non-weapons-grade plutonium-238 production is moved to Idaho. It was Jay Coughlin of Nuclear Watch of New Mexico who unearthed the report.
Both Congress and the Department of Energy have long harped on the fact that Los Alamos has to get its act together to produce plutonium pits for the U.S. Stockpile. And as a matter of logic, if they're able to increase the floor space by moving non-weapons activities out, that would enhance Los Alamos's capability to actually make plutonium pits.
Coughlin says the DOE can now produce 10 plutonium bomb cores per year at Los Alamos. The DOE's other nuclear bomb factory, Rocky Flats, near Denver, was shut down in years past by an FBI raid. Coughlin says he's recently received a comprehensive site plan for Los Alamos that has all aspects of the site's future blacked out, including estimates for future bomb production. He says it's believed that the DOE wants to be able to produce 40 to 50 plutonium pits per year there.
This country is beginning to rebuild its nuclear weapons arsenal for the long term, while at the same time, dismantlements of warheads have come to a virtual halt.
The department's proposal to consolidate PU-238 operations at Idaho was not based on the need to free up floor space for pit production.
Department of Energy spokesman Brad Bugger sticks with the rationale for consolidating non-weapons-grade plutonium-238 production that Idahoans were given at public hearings last summer.
The consolidation was proposed to increase security and efficiency of the radioisotope power system production that's now spread across facilities in Tennessee, New Mexico, and Idaho. So while the conference report in Congress recognizes the benefits from freeing up floor space at TA-55 at Los Alamos, this was not the driver for proposing consolidation.
Jeremy Maxand of the Idaho-based Nuke Watch group Snake River Alliance says the revelations about bomb production are very damaging to the DOE's case for consolidating plutonium-238 production at Idaho National Laboratory. He notes the isotope production in Idaho will be done in a nearly 40-year-old reactor located in an earthquake zone. The DOE says the reactor in Idaho regularly has its parts replaced and has safely been producing other isotopes, such as those used for medicine, for years. But Maxand says Idahoans have much to be concerned about.
We could be taking a project into our state that has a history of contaminating workers and contaminating the environment. I mean, the government has demonstrated clearly that they, in no way, shape, or form can manage plutonium in a way that protects people and the environment.
A decision is expected to be made on the Idaho project sometime next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartes in Moscow, Idaho.
A decade after business processing outsourcing, or BPO, became the most lucrative job opportunity for a large number of young graduates, left-leaning Indian parties have called for forming trade unions to protect workers' interests. But the employees themselves have distanced themselves from the idea and have also denied the claim made by established union leaders that any attempt to form a trade union or association by BPO sector employees is being curbed by the threat of dismissal. And, as FSRN correspondent Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad, efforts are now underway to establish India's first nationwide union of IT workers by the end of 2006.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Goa. The Call Centers Association of India has categorically stated that international business is no place for unions. They cite the working conditions and the wages in the sector, which contributes 4.5% to the country's gross domestic product, the best available in the country. Employees like Muralidhar Singh, a call center executive in Western India, agrees.
It's not, you know, exactly like the way it happens in normal factory kind of place. First thing is that you feel like doing so when you feel that you're exploited or something unfair has been done to me.
Singh works for Motif, rated as one of the top 10 companies in India in the BPO segment. Apart from a high salary, he also gets to work in a world-class infrastructure, free transportation, subsidized meals, and even profit-sharing and comprehensive insurance benefits. His CEO, Kaushal Mehta, is the founder of 550-seater Motif and employs 400 employees who work round the clock for some of the top companies in the world. Mehta is happy that many of his employees see no need to unionize.
So we have to have such a strong, powerful environment where we only deliver the best. Now, do you think I can tell my client that five people in a group of 50 will always not perform, but I am tied by a union? Now tell me, if I get unions and I have to keep low performers in my environment, am I doing injustice to the other 95% who are working 14, 16 hours a day for the last 5 years?
The Communist Party of India is not satisfied and says it will educate workers in the sector to organize themselves and will request that the Indian government create labor laws for the IT sector. But people who have worked closely with the BPO sector says trade unions may not be the answer because in many public sector undertakings, it is the trade unions which are exploiting the employees. Sunita Kaul just quit a BPO job in Western Indian city of Ahmedabad.
Call has come now because it's only now that we are really reaping the fruits of that industry, which was once a sunrise industry and is now a full-fledged blooming sector. In fact, we are going to evolve beyond this. Only now are they waking up to the fact that, oh, there is a sector here which is untapped and perhaps we can kind of make inroads into this. I am all for having some kind of a forum which will protect interests of employees of all kinds, but I personally do not think that trade unionism is the answer.
Recently, Gartner, a global consultancy firm, backed the idea saying the formation of trade union is a mark for the Indian IT sector attaining maturity. But investors say it would hamper India's image as one of the most favorite BPO investment destinations. They feel there are hardly any unfair HR policies and stresses that night shifts a part of the job.
Sorry, there is no reply from the number you have called.
From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. For more information or to get archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.